The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's January 7th, 2007, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Earl Evans, and this is the show where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right. Here we're all about old school computing and modern day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, CPM, cartridge slots, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right podcast. This is show number 71, and today's topic, an interview with Rob O'Hara, part 1. Information about the RetroBits podcast can be found at our podcast hosting site. That URL is RetroBits, R-E-T-R-O-B-I-T-S, .libsyn.com. If you'd like to send email, the email address here is RetroBits@gmail.com. And if you'd like to join in on our online interactive discussion forum, you can find that at RetroBits.petsky. That's P-E-T-S-C-I-I.com. Happy 2007, everybody. It's great to be back behind the microphone here after a couple of weeks off. I do have to admit I enjoyed it. I took a week off from work and just kind of hung around the house with my family. We all just kind of stuck around and, you know, enjoyed some much needed stress reduction. And of course, you know, the holidays and Santa was really good to all of us this year. So we just had a great time. But it is good to be back. Today is part one of an exciting two-part show, an interview with Rob O'Hara, author of the book Commodork, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie. For those of you unfamiliar with the book, here's some verbiage from the official website. And I'm quoting here, "Long before the World Wide Web and high-speed internet had arrived, computer-based bulletin board systems, or BBSs, ruled the land. Commodork, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie, is a tribute to those times, back when high-speed access meant 1,200 baud and 5 1/4-inch floppies were king." The book takes readers on my, that is Rob's, personal BBS journey and stretches almost 20 years, beginning with my first experiences with a home computer, a TRS-80 Model 3, and ending in the mid-1990s, when the internet began arriving in people's homes and driving the final nail into one of the most exciting and explosive hobbies of all time. Now, I read this book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Myself, having lived through the early years of microcomputing, it was a joy for me to read this memoir and reminisce. Now, there's lots of material in the interview, so I'm going to skip our email and news section this week and get right to it. So, here we go. And I'll be back afterwards to close it out. Hey, it's Earl Evans with the RetroBits Podcast, and on the phone with me is Rob O'Hara. Rob is the author of the book, Commodork, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie. Hey, Rob, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing tonight, Earl?
I'm good. Thanks a million for being on the podcast. I appreciate you taking some of your time here tonight to talk to us.
Hey, no problem. I appreciate the call.
So, I read that book. I really enjoyed it. I suspect, like a lot of the other comments that you've received, I saw some on your site, it brought back a lot of memories for me, you know, a lot of shared experiences or a shared hallucination, if you will. So thanks for that. I mean, that was a really fun read.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, probably the biggest comment I've got from people that have read the book is that people are amazed at how similar their experiences were as mine. And, you know, I've had people, you know, in the country. I've had people from Canada, Mexico. I've even sold some books to New Zealand. And it's amazing how all of our experiences for, you know, those of us that are of that age that grew up on BBSs, we really, you know, a lot of us have the same stories.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fun time in the 80s. And the 90s. It was, you know, really a kick. And both reading your book and watching some of the BBS documentary by Jason Scott,
yeah.
I mean, both of those things have made me wish that I had been into the BBS scene a little bit more back then. I was into the computers of the day, but I only called BBSs every now and then, which is, you know, kind of shame on me, too, because some of my best friends were sysops.
You know, one statement I made at the beginning of the book was, before we had the World Wide Web, we had the Wild Wild West.
Right.
It was really like that. It was, you know, when you think about the Old West, you think of, you know, guys on horses and really, like, no laws and just kind of this, you know, making things up as you went along. And that's how BBSs were. There weren't, today, you know, if there are illegal things, let's say, going on the Internet, there are three-letter agencies that are out there looking for that type of thing.
Right.
There are people monitoring for software piracy or for, you know, illegal activities. But in the BBS world, there wasn't anything like that going on. You know, a person would set up a BBS in their home, and the phone number would get out, and people would call it. So there really wasn't any way, since it wasn't centralized like the Internet is now. So since it was, you know, all split up like that, there wasn't any way to monitor all the BBSs all the time. Now, occasionally, you know, there would be rumors that a particular user might be tied to a law enforcement agency or something like that, but nothing like it is today. So it really was just kind of, you know, wild and lawlessness going on.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, decentralization has its advantages, and, you know, the fact is, back then, you're kind of flying under the radar.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, if you wanted to fly under the radar now, it would be the perfect way to do it because it's such an obscure means of connecting with other people these days, you know.
Yeah, that's true. You know, as much as I enjoyed that book, I was wondering, what inspired you to write that? I mean, you covered this somewhat in the text of the book, but I was just curious if you could give the listeners, you know, the impression of what sort of things prompted you to write this.
Well, I still have my old computers, the computers that I have that I write about in the book, the computers from the early 80s, I still have those, and I still play a lot of the old games that I play, and I have, you know, the same diskettes that I had back then. And I'll pull these diskettes out, you know. I don't necessarily play that stuff every day, but, you know, maybe a couple of times a year I pull them out, and I noticed that over the last few years those discs have started to fade. You know, I don't think they were really intended for us to, you know, be playing these same, you know, floppy discs 25 years later.
No, they're well past their shelf life, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same kind of thing started happening with my memory as well. I noticed that when I would, you know, tell these stories to my friends, I started getting details mixed up a little bit. Like, you know, I would throw somebody into a story and then realize, well, I hadn't met that person yet. So they couldn't possibly be in the story that I had just told, you know. And so there was kind of this strange parallel of the old hardware dying and starting to fade at the same time that my memory was starting to fade. So that's kind of what prompted me to, not necessarily to write the book, but to just start writing these stories down, to have some sort of, you know, archive. Something that Internet users can probably relate to is there's a big question of who's archiving all the stuff that's out there on the Internet. You know, a web page goes up, it has information on it, you reference it every day, and then tomorrow if that web page is gone, there's no archive of that data.
Right.
And so it was the same thing with these stories. You know, once these BBSs have been turned off, there's no record of these stories. It's just what lives in our memory, you know. And so that's really what kind of started getting me writing these stories down. Now, I had also seen, after I had started doing that, I saw Jason Scott's BBS documentary. And it really, I guess, but when I started writing it, I didn't really know why I was writing these things down. I didn't know that there would be a market. But then when I saw that, I realized, you know what, there are other people that remember that time, and you know, that they'd be able to relate to those stories too. So that's kind of how it started getting put together.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's a lot of people from that day, and I think it is an important time. I mean, you know, both the BBS world and the online system world, like a CompuServe or you know, various things like that, like Quantum Link for the Commodore world, and between those things, they really set the stage for people at home to be able to connect to the internet when it came along, because they already had some of the gear that they needed.
Right, and everything that we have on the internet now, we had on BBSs back then. It just wasn't quite as developed. You know, we were able to transfer files, but of course, due to modem speeds, we weren't able to do that as quickly. We were able to chat with people like, you know, you do now on IRC or in chat rooms or whatever, but you were limited to however many phone lines a particular BBS had. Usually chatting was between, you know, a user and a sysop, just two people, but as the years went by, you know, multi-line BBSs came out, and a BBS might have, you know, eight lines or something like that, and then eight people could chat, which was mind-blowing. You're like, boy, eight people at once, all typing, you know, how are you going to keep track of that, where the chat rooms today might have hundreds of people in there. But, so, yeah, it did kind of, the things that we had back then did eventually develop, but like I said, the biggest difference is that decentralization. There was no, you know, Google. There was no search engine. Each BBS was an entirely standalone island. So, like, one good example of that is back then, you know, you had email, but it was tied to a particular system. So
right.
You might send another user a message, and they might get it, you know, for 3 or 4 days, and they wouldn't get it until they dialed into that system.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, possible to have, you know, different conversations going on at different systems. It was similar to the internet, but much slower. It wasn't uncommon for a conversation to unfold over a matter of weeks or months. You know, yeah, someone would start a post, just like with forums today, but, you know, someone might call 4 hours later and respond, and someone might call a couple of days later and respond. So it was similar, but just much, much slower.
Yeah, and you know, I agree, an important kind of, an important part of our computing legacy to capture. So that's one of the reasons I was so glad to see your book and read it. You know, it's just these kind of experiences are great, and they're fun too. You know, I was wondering, how long did the book take to write?
Once I actually, you know, I started jotting these ideas down, probably from start to finish, it was definitely less than a year, maybe 8 or 9 months to put everything together, and that's from the beginning, like coming up with the ideas and writing all the way to getting it, you know, in its final form, like assembling those ideas and turning that into a book. There's like a magic kind of stage where it goes from being unrelated stories to, you know, chapters to finally having a table of contents and then turning that soft document into a book.
That's just amazing. That's a lot less time than what I had anticipated. I mean, you got, like you say, you got to come up with all of those vignettes, and then you have to find a way to glue them all together. You did a great job. I mean, that's really kind of quick.
Thanks. Yeah, the advantage that I had was my book required very little research. You know, when I started writing it, I just kind of sat down and wrote this timeline, you know, and then I just started thinking of different stories that I had, and I would just mark them on the timeline, and so that was really, you know, at the very beginning, I just set out, you know, I opened up Notepad and said, okay, here are my BBS stories, and I would just jot down little keywords to particular stories, and then from there, I just, you know, started organizing them and stuff, and actually, organizing the book was one of my biggest challenges.
I was going to ask what sort of challenges you ran into.
The when you write a book, obviously you have to present that information to the reader in some sort of logical manner. And in a type of story like this, which is basically a memoir, what's the best way to say this? The way that you present it is chronological.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't simply say, okay, well, the first day I got my computer, and that was really neat. And then the second day, you know, you have to group those stories together in some sort of organization. And so that became a challenge to me. How do you group stories topically and still keep it chronological? When I gave the book to my wife and she did the final read-through, I had a story, like, in chapter 4, that talked about how me and a friend of mine had gone on these adventures, and then in the next chapter, I introduced him.
Right.
So it was out of order. I had taken a story out of chronological order, and all of a sudden it didn't make sense. The other challenge by doing it chronologically is I had to cover 15 years in 160, 170 pages. So a lot of things get left out. One of the comments that a friend of mine made was, you know, there's one character in the book who is a friend of mine, and then later when you hear about him, we're not friends, and then later when you hear about him, we are friends. And so to the reader, it seems kind of disjointed. It's like, well, this is weird, but you have to realize when you're looking at the book, I mean, you're looking at, you know, maybe over 10 years when this guy just happened to come about, you know, in random parts.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that was the biggest thing for me was the organization. The writing part was actually pretty easy. Like I said, the stories, you know, wrote themselves. They were just memories, and I've told a lot of these stories to, you know, friends or whatever. So, you know, writing them down was easy, but just grouping them together in some sort of logical order, that was the hardest part.
Well, you know, I've actually thought about writing a book myself, and I've talked to some people who have as well. You know, a few subjects have kind of bounced around in my head over time. I mean, one of the things is I'm a information security guy, you know, for my day job. Mm-hmm. And there have been subjects occasionally that have crossed my mind that I thought, wonder if I should write about that. I noticed that you self-published the book through, I think it's lulu.com.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I considered doing that as well, something like that. Do you have any hints for the aspiring writer, you know, myself included? How do you stay on course? How do you get it done?
Well, when I first started writing the book, like I said, what I did was I started grouping these topics together, and then when I came up with, let's say, three stories on the same idea, I would say, okay, that's going to be a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had several stories about copy fests, which were parties where computer owners would get together and basically trade software. Now, you have to remember, back then, we're talking about, you know, 300 baud, 1200 baud, not, you know, cable modems and stuff like what we have
right.
today.
Right.
So, you know, transferring one game to a friend of yours might take 4 or 5 hours. So if you were going to trade, you know, several programs with something, it really was simpler to say, hey, you know, next week let's get together and we'll just trade games back and forth. And so these copy fests basically became parties where, you know, if two people getting together and trading software was good, then 20 people doing it was better. And
sure.
It was just like what you can imagine. I mean, it was a bunch of teenagers sitting in a room. Everybody brought their computers, and everybody brought all their software, and then you just went around the room and met people, you know, and there's always that awkward thing of BBSs that doesn't, I mean, it does happen on the internet, but not as much because the internet's so much bigger, but on BBSs, you know, you were constantly meeting people in person that you had met online, and a lot of the time, it was, you know, you might not even know someone's real name. You just, you know, knew their alias. I remember there's a story in the book where I met this guy. He turned out to work at a hospital. He walks up to me and says, "Hi, my name is Dragon Spit."
Uh-huh.
They're like, "Nice to meet you, Dragon Spit," you know? So, and it was easier to, and that's one thing I did in the book, I'm sure you noticed, is I stuck with everybody's aliases.
I did notice that. I was halfway wondering if I should call you Jack Flack when we were having the conversation.
Well, my license plate actually says Flack, so it wouldn't be completely out of the ordinary. But, yeah, you know, the idea with that is that because all those people were really characters, you know. I mean, when you met someone online, they were this online persona, and it did kind of carry over into real life. But anyway, hints for the aspiring writer, you know, I would say the one thing I would tell you is write what you want to write. I got a lot, you know, when people found out that I was working on this project, I got a lot of emails that said, you know, well, you should do this or you should do that. Well, I already knew what I was going to do. I was going to write my story.
Right.
So, you know, once I got it organized, I just came home and wrote a little bit and, you know, it just kind of fell together. And since then, you know, I've received lots and lots of emails from people who've bought the book and read it, and most of them have been pretty positive. The few complaints that I have got have been where people have said, you know, well, you didn't talk about this. You didn't cover this. This was really important to me, and, you know, my only response to those people is, you know, I wrote my story. I wrote my experiences and stuff. And
right.
But, and there's some of those things we can talk about later, but there's certain topics that I, you know, I just never encountered. I'll tell you, one is FidoNet. I wasn't a FidoNet person, and most of the boards around here weren't FidoNet. And I, you know, had people that were like, how could you not have talked about FidoNet? But, you know, it just wasn't an experience of mine. But I tell you what, if somebody wanted to write a book about FidoNet, there would be lots of people would love you for that.
Oh, no, sure, sure. And, you know, that's an interesting thing that you bring up, because there was, as I recall, an entire chapter about that in the BBS documentary. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've talked to Jason Scott about this since my book came out, and compared it, you know, to his documentary. And, you know, he says he gets complaints from people, too, of, you know, well, why didn't you cover this, or why didn't you put this person in there, or whatever. And so...
Well, you just can't cover it all.
It becomes a thing where eventually you have to just, you know, block down what you're going to turn out, what your product is.
Mm-hmm.
And you just make it the best that you can do, you know, and then you put that out. Now, I will tell you one piece of advice that I would definitely recommend to anyone who's writing a book, self-published or otherwise, is get an editor. That is something that I didn't do, and that's probably, of everything that I did, that's probably the only real regret. I have a associate's degree in English, and I've worked as an editor, and I write columns for lots of websites, and I've written columns for magazines before, and so I'm a writer. I'm a pretty good writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I went back and read through the book, I thought, of course, this is my story. This is great. The day before I sent it to Lulu to have it published, I let my wife read it. She's the first person who read it beginning to end, and she gave it back and said, well, I found, you know, a couple of errors. I circled them. And as I went through, she had found errors on almost every page.
Oh, no.
some of them were typographical errors, and those are the easy ones. Those are the ones that when you read your own book, it's just like what your, you know, professors or your teachers used to say, you know, you write something, leave it alone for a couple of days, come back to it and read it, you know, and those things will jump out to you. But what didn't jump out to me were the logic type errors. Like I said, the stories that would be out of order, or characters that, you know, appeared where in my mind it made sense because I remembered this person, but when reading it, you know, from a stranger's point of view, they don't know who that person is.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the type of things that an editor can help you with. And it doesn't have to be, you know, some big professional editor or something, but, you know, maybe a college professor that you had, an English professor, but another set of eyes to look at that is invaluable. And that's, and Jason Scott has actually kidded me, and he said, you know, I have the advantage because I can go through and fix my errors where, you know, if he has errors in his DVD, that's it.
Right.
He can't fix those things. And I have actually updated the book and resent it into Lulu to fix some of those. You know, most of the problems are little minor things, but of course, once you see them, they're just glaring. They just, you know, jump out at you, and they'll just bug you forever. But that would be
well. Yeah, don't let that distract you from, the pride and the accomplishment of the work. I mean, like I say, I really
well,
like
thanks.
It.
Yeah, it's,
I mean, overall, do you like the way the book came out?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, having your book published is an interesting thing. There are a couple of different ways to get a book published. And one is what most people imagine as being published, and that is you write a manuscript, you send it off to a book company, and the book company says, oh my goodness, this is a wonderful piece of literature, we're going to pay you lots and lots of money, and they send you money and they buy your book, and it, you know, is a bestseller, and the thing is, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
It's, you know, a nice story, and it would be nice if that happened, but especially for, you know, someone like me, first time writer, writing about a fairly obscure topic, you know, that's just not going to happen. And so that's when I started checking into Lulu. And Lulu's not the only one out there. It's just the one that I happened to pick. You know, I read some different reviews, and people had good things to say about it. But let me tell you, my book, the day before I sent it to Lulu, or I mean the minute before I sent it to Lulu, is a Microsoft Word document. It's not anything that anybody else could not produce in their house, and that's what I did. You know, I wrote that book on my laptop in a Microsoft Word document. When you come up with your finished product, you upload that to Lulu, it converts it to a PDF, and there's some technical things that go on, but the basic the basic idea is that you write a Microsoft Word document, you upload it, and magically they send it off to a printer, and that becomes your book.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the thing that's nice about it is it takes away the technical aspect. I don't have to know what kind of paper or anything about the printing process or binding or shipping or anything. You upload that, and that whole process is entirely free. And now what Lulu does is they take a percentage off of every book that's sold. For my book, it's roughly, I think, about $6.
And so in a sense, you can kind of have the books on demand too, right?
That's exactly how they work. You're right. So I go into Lulu and I set my price. Let's say I want to sell my book for $10.
Mm-hmm.
I go into Lulu and I set that price for $10. So you go into Lulu, you find my book, and you purchase it. They have a payment type system already set up. You pay through Lulu. Lulu takes $6 and they send $4. They save it. You can set up I think mine's set up through PayPal. So once a month, I get a thing from Lulu and it says, "Hey, this is how many copies you sold, and here's your little lump sum." The problem is, Lulu is an entire website of writers, not people looking to buy other people's books.
Oh, right. So you got to promote it somehow.
The next step is to get your book listed on Amazon, which is actually simpler than most people think. What you have to do is you have to go buy an ISBN number, and Lulu has that process already set up. It costs another $100, but once you do that, it actually gets a serial number, and it becomes, a legitimate book that shows up in trade magazines, and it shows up on online retailers. So after you purchase that, after a couple of weeks, my book started showing up in Amazon, like Barnes & Noble online, Borders online. I think there's about 13 different major websites that my book shows up in now. Amazon charges a $4 handling fee for every book that sells. So once you make that step, you're now hedging your bets on quantity.
Right.
Because now our $10 book, Lulu actually makes $5.88 on. Amazon takes $4. So now my $10 book, I get 12 cents.
Uh-huh.
Which is why my book sells for $15 and not $10, which is what I originally wanted to do.
Yeah, understood.
Jason Scott actually gave me some great advice. And I talked to him right before I started selling the book on Lulu, and he said a piece of advice that had been given to him as well is that you can always go down in your price, but you can never go up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I went with the $15 price that's on there, is because once it goes to Amazon, that it takes a big chunk out. Now, on the other hand, I have sold lots of books where people have gone onto Amazon, gone into the computer book section, and just randomly picked my book.
Right.
So, it's a double-edged sword.
If somebody went on there and searched for something like Commodore, your book is probably one of the ones that would come up.
Right, absolutely. So, yeah, like I said, it's that double-edged sword where you say, I'm having a much wider audience, but a much lower profit margin.
Sure. Now, on the contents of the book, as I was reading it, I had a whole bunch of reminiscing of my own, and also some questions that were popping up into my head. One of them was, back in the Commodore days, I had a friend of mine named Fred, and Fred collected every piece of software that was on Earth. It sounds like very similar to yourself.
Right.
One of the things that I always wondered about was And of course, you know, most of them were games because I don't know what percentage, but I've got to believe that a huge percentage of the software packages for the 8-bit computers were gaming and entertainment.
Oh, sure.
And I was wondering how he would ever find the time to play all those games, if it was something that he actually did, or if it was kind of just the thrill of collecting. And I wondered that about you also when I was reading through this. Was it like the quest of collecting?
Oh, absolutely. The games are what get you into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see games and you play them and you're like, well, this is great. And then your instinct is, well, I want more games. And so to get more games, you have to have games. So then you start, you know, trading software and you say, well, you know, I have these three games, and you have those three games, so let's trade, and then we'll each have six games. And it becomes this cycle where it stops, at some point it stops being about the games, and it just starts being about the numbers.
Uh-huh.
And it also starts being about, in the BBS days, well, again, to compare it to the internet, the internet, right now, I can go online and I could go to a website in Taiwan and I could download something. It's no big deal. But back then, it was a big deal. Number one, because you don't know anyone in Taiwan. I don't, you know.
Right.
So there were these, you know, the big cracking groups that were releasing software weren't located in Oklahoma.
Exactly.
In California and New York and Florida and Chicago and these big cities. So
I was losing you just a second ago there,
oh,
Rob.
Sorry.
No, you're back. You're back. You're fine.
Okay.
But just to let you know, you kind of went dead on me there for a second.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was saying is the big cracking groups weren't located here in Oklahoma.
Right.
They were located, like in California, Florida, and there were lots of BBSs in Chicago and New York, places like that. So if we weren't coming out with the software, it became this race of who could get it the quickest. You know, there were BBSs that would rank their file areas, you know, okay, well, I only do 0 to 30-day games, which meant, you know, that a game would have to be released within the last 30 days, you know, for them to even have it, you know, on their bulletin board.
Ah, I see. Almost like it goes stale after a while.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and of course, you know, there were people that would say, well, 0 to 90 was fairly common, and that was, you know, if you think about, like I said, that comparison, we're now on the internet, a download just takes however long it takes to download. But, you know, back then it was, well, you probably weren't calling California. You know, someone in Phoenix may have called California, and they might also call, you know, BBS in New Mexico, and someone else you might know might call that. So it took, you know, time for these things to migrate around the country. So when you start having these labels of time and date stamps and stuff like that, then it becomes more of a race. And it's that whole collecting mentality, just like where, you know, baseball cards are, and, you know, a great example is I don't so much anymore, but I used to have a really large Star Wars collection.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, you know, you go, well, there's these new, you know, a new set of Star Wars figures coming out, and you go buy them. And after a while, you know, you're just buying stuff. You're not opening it anymore. You're not playing with it. And after a while, you don't even enjoy it anymore. But it's just, you know, that collector, well, I have to have them all. You know, I have to have everything. And, you know, the computer days, I mean, I think the Commodore peaked out at close to 20,000 games. So,
wow.
You know, there was never an end in sight. There was always something else. There was something new always coming, you know. But, no, to answer your question, after a while, it wasn't about playing the games anymore. It was about, you know, just having that collection. And it was always, you know, every day when you woke up, there was going to be something new out there. And I'll tell you, one thing I've noticed even recently with, like, the console games and stuff like that is whenever you buy a game, you have an investment in that game. You know, you've spent money on this program and you come home and you play it, and now, you know, you really want to get your money's worth out of it.
Right. We've got that scenario on our GameCube, you know.
Yeah.
When the kids get a game, you know, or sometimes even the old man here, then, then yeah, no, I see what you're saying.
Right. So you have, you know, this monetary attachment to this item. You know, you pay $50 for a game now, or, you know, I just got a PlayStation 3 and now all those games are $60. And I think, well, I've got to get $60 worth of enjoyment out of this, you know, and I'm playing the same games over and over and, you know, you really want to beat it. Whereas, you know, if you went to a copy fest and let's say you got, you know, 20 discs and each of those discs had, you know, three games on each side, you know, so now you have, a couple hundred new games, you're not going to play a bad game.
You'll
load it up and you go, well, this game is terrible, let's go on to the next one. And so, you know, it didn't matter how many games you got, it was just, you would look at that batch and play, you know, a couple of good games out of that batch. Where I really see it is, like, if you look at retro video game consoles, like the Atari or the Intellivision, you know, there were games that, I mean, I played, you know, for days or weeks or months, you know, I mean, invested a lot of time in these old games, and now, if you get them, you know, like, you know, through emulators or people get them and they go, well, that's terrible, next. You know, they won't spend a second to play a game that I played, you know, for months at a time.
Yeah, you know, I never thought about it that way, but I've got a real Atari 800, and, you know, there's some archives out there where, you know, all the games are. And, yeah, I mean, if a game's not good, you just move on.
Right, exactly.
Go to the next one.
And, you know, like I said, there were lots of games that, looking back now, probably weren't very good. But, you know, if that was the only game you got for Christmas, you were going to play it. You were going to play it for a long time.
Did you have some favorites?
You know, I always liked the old Electronic Arts games. I liked Realm of Impossibility was a favorite of mine. I really liked the Bard's Tale games back then. You know, the early dungeon hack type games where you know, Wizardry was a big one for us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. Paradroids, one of my favorite games of all time. I don't know if you've played that or not. But
you know, I have. It's been a while, though. You must enjoy them to some level. I mean, I saw the picture there of your arcade room.
Yeah, that's another strange collection of mine, along with
man, that looks fun.
And old computers. How did that begin? You know, I went. I had a friend who turned me on to an arcade auction, and he said that they were actually selling arcade games, just like, you know, like the arcades that the people in my age group grew up in. And I was like, well, people think that they're expensive because they're large.
Right.
And so, but there's actually about three different price groups. There's the classic games, and whenever you talk to someone about arcade games, they can name about 10 games, and those are going to be those games. You know, the Pac-Man, Miss Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, Centipede.
Defender.
Yeah, Defender, yeah.
That kind of stuff. Uh-huh.
Those games are classics, and those are going to cost you a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are newer games. Now, you have to realize who are selling these games, and it's people that are coin operators. Either they own arcades or they own locations. And so what's important to them are games that make money. So anything that you could put on location and is still going to make them money is going to be expensive.
That makes sense.
Yeah, now that leaves a big, huge gap of video games in the middle that nobody cares about. The collectors don't care about them. You know, maybe they're games that have been converted or something like that, and if they don't make any money, they're not worth anything to the operators. So the first arcade auction that I went to, I ended up picking up a couple of arcade games for $25 or $30 each, and that just kind of got me hooked. I just couldn't believe that, you know, you could get a deal like that. And pretty much everything that I buy needs some sort of repair.
Well, that must mean you've plugged into the community or the resources that it would take to actually repair those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's really not that much that could go wrong with them. Over the years, there's two basic types of repair. They either need physical repair or they're going to need electronic work. And when you get into the electronic work, there's just not that much to them. There's a power supply, there's a monitor, which is basically very similar to, you know, a television tube, And, you know, there are people out there, there's all the resources you need are out there on the internet. There's schematics and diagrams and people who fix things and people who will help you fix things. So if you shop at the level of arcade game that I buy, then you'll either have to learn how to repair them or you'll have to pay people to repair them.
Gotcha.
And you know, when I started buying arcade games, I bought a bunch of stuff that I just kind of got excited about the hobby. I bought a lot of games that, you know, may have looked like fun or whatever, but weren't really favorites of mine. And so what I've been doing over the last few years is getting rid of the ones that I don't play and you know, trading up.
I see.
And so now I have, you know, Karate Champ and Gauntlet and Shinobi and all the games, you know, Q-Bird, the games that I really liked as a kid. So it's a slow process. But
I could just never.
And,
I could never beat Q-Bird. That game just that's my white whale, man. I don't know what it is.
I say I'm awful at it. My wife's really good at it. But the one thing about arcade games, if nothing else, is there's that wow factor where when people come in, they're just astonished, you know, to see these huge giant games that you normally don't see in someone's house.
Right.
So yeah, it's a fun little hobby. It's it's actually horrible if you think about it. You know, the logistics behind doing it are so ridiculous that nobody should ever collect arcade games.
Well, you certainly need a lot of room.
You know, you have a lot of room involved. You have, they you know, give off a lot of heat, so you're going to have some sort of air conditioning. You're going to have, logistically, you have to have ways to move these things. You're going to have a trailer or a pickup or someone who will loan you one all the time. And dollies and straps and all these things that go with it. And then, like I said, you know, a lot of these games have been turned on and left on for 10 or 20 years. So it's kind of like, I don't know if you have, I have a computer that's the same way, that it works great when it's on, and if I ever turn it off and then turn it back on, I know something's going to die. So I just leave it on all the time. You know?
Yeah, you never want to. I mean, we had some old Sun, you know, Unix storage boxes.
Right.
At a company that I worked for, and they were getting kind of, you know, old and dusty, and you never wanted to turn those things off. I mean, they're kind of the, you know, that point in time, there were the rough equivalent of what today we'd call storage area networks, you know, sandboxes, and
right.
That, boy, yeah, we just put tape over the switch.
Unfortunately, that's all I've got time to bring you this week. But tune in next week for part two. Thanks a million to Rob, a.k.a. Jack Flack, for this great interview. I'm telling you, I really enjoyed it. For access to the show notes, including any of the links that we talk about, and this week it's just one, the official website for the Commodore book, you can go to retrobits.libsyn.com. The email address again, retrobits@gmail.com. And drop on by, join us on our online interactive discussion forum at retrobits.petsky.com. I hope you all have a fantastic week. I will see you again in 7 days. And until then, take care. Bye-bye.